Hello and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics, the twice weekly podcast with me, Steve Richards. Thanks so much for tuning in wherever you are in the UK and indeed around the rest of the world. And you know what I'm going to say next? We have got a lot to cram in our time together on this podcast. If it's okay with all of you, I'm going to despair calmly, but remember the calm is an act, about the level of debate in the UK in relation to immigration. It's so low. And I'll explore why and contextualise to some extent the lack of, you know, we delve deeply in this podcast, the lack of delving deeply on at any, from any perspective in this immigration debate, which of course is reaching another sort of apoplectic, hysterical denouement this week with immigration figures showing an increase. You know, now are we going to protect our borders, Brexit taking back control? And there we have the increase for reasons which we shall explore. Anyway, that's what I will be reflecting on. We've got some fantastic emails from you, including, of course, on that extraordinary gathering last week, the NatCon conference. Yeah, I reflected more last week on the one in Bournemouth. You had a choice of conferences because when I recorded, the NatCon one had only just kicked off and I wanted to see it and explore it before reflecting on it. Anyway, the emails give us an opportunity to reflect a bit on that and many other topics too. Just one notice, it's a big one. That is, Rock and Roll Politics is back at the Edinburgh Festival live this August for the last 2 weeks of the festival, August the 13th to the 26th, every day, and a different show every day as we move from one angle to another, one deep theme to another, with some fun. Tickets are on sale at the Fringe website, and it will be at the usual venue, the amphitheatre, the space at Symposium Hall. Do come along. And we will have some fun together at the Edinburgh Festival. But we're not going to have fun now because I'm going to reflect for a bit on immigration with several vignettes or observations, which is along these lines. First of all, whenever you hear from a business leader or a senior figure, like, for example, the governor of the Bank of England, when they're asked about what businesses reflect on the biggest cause of the various crises facing them at the moment, they all say labour shortages. They don't say shortages, they don't say inflation, although, of course, that is a factor too. They say labour shortages. And yet, in that context, and we know, by the way, it's true not just in the private sector, but in the public sector, shortage of nurses, shortage of doctors in the health service and many other examples. And yet, when we hear that immigration figures are up, there is a kind of hysteria, wholly at odds with the broader context, which is we need people to fill these vacancies. This is example one of the immaturity of the debate, that everything disconnects. So you hear about immigration figures. Suala Braverman, incidentally in charge of immigration, has expressed her horror that the figures are going up. And yet there is Jeremy Hunt in the Treasury, knowing that the economy, to secure economic growth, demands that these vacancies are filled somehow or other. And then you hear Keir Starmer being interviewed about immigration and saying that immigration will fall under a Labour government, without then saying how he will secure one of his missions, these famous or not so famous missions, which is to generate the highest level of growth in the G7. Now, how you do that without addressing the crisis in the labour market, no one can answer. So this is madness. No one says or dares to say, although I assume Keir Starmer knows this to be the case, that a cause of Britain's pathetic economic performance is labour shortages that arose from Lord Frosty Frost's Brexit deal and Johnson's Brexit deal, that dynamic duo that has done so much harm to this country. And of course, to some extent, the pandemic, where lots of people decided they didn't want to go back to work. And in the short term, there is one answer, and that is bringing people over to fill the vacancies. No one can say it, because there is this disconnect in the conversation about what's going on in the British economy. So that's the first observation. Labour shortages are the biggest cause of the crisis in the British economy, and yet there is horror at rising immigration to fill some of those vacancies. The next is another vignette, if you like, and that was when Johnson was Prime Minister. He had a conversation with the President of the National Farmers Union, Minette Batters. And during it, Johnson famously said to her, because she reported it subsequently, "Oh, Minette, I'd rather die than do anything to harm the farmers. I'd rather die." And Minette Batters, to this very day, can't work out whether he believed it at the time, whether he was lying to her, because very soon afterwards they announced the deal with New Zealand that harmed the farmers, as did Johnson and Frosty's Brexit deal. But she then specifically rose one issue. She said, "We need the fruit pickers urgently. We're not able to pick the fruit and the vegetables because those from the European Union who came here to do the fruit picking, it's too difficult for them to come." And Johnson said to her, "Oh, Minette, you can get the fruit pickers. We'll make sure you get the fruit pickers. It just can't be from the European Union. We'll get them from Australia. We'll get them from New Zealand. We'll get them from the Commonwealth more widely, but just not the European Union. But we will get them." Now, Johnson said that partly because he is incapable of challenging reality. And that reality was and still is, by the way, that fruit and vegetables are not being picked at the scale that they are being produced and are just rotting away. Another example of the insane consequences of the hard Brexit that Britain is living through. But Johnson's response was interesting on another level. He was not saying to Minette Batters, "We want the numbers down as a matter of principle, and if you can't pick the fruit and the vegetables as a result, so be it, because we have a plan to protect the borders and keep Britain British and not allow anyone in." He didn't say that. He just said, "We won't allow the old EU lot in because we want to show that our ending of freedom of movement is working. But that means you can have loads of non-EU people in to pick the fruit." And in a way, this is an example of the absurd dance over immigration in Britain, because for a period under New Labour, the opposite applied. When famously Tony Blair allowed freedom of movement to begin from day one without the sort of transitional controls other countries applied, New Labour became wary of immigration too, because they knew how it was perceived and how it would be reported more than on any other issue. So they made it much more difficult, in theory anyway, for non-EU workers to come here, knowing and wanting the EU workers to come, even if they underestimated the numbers by a considerable amount. But that was the Johnson line. You know, if Brexit was about lowering the numbers coming here for some, that's not what Johnson thought. He just wanted, in some sort of crazy way, for it not to be the incredibly hard workers from Eastern Europe who used to come here and pick fruit from dawn to dusk. He was okay if it was from Australia, New Zealand, or elsewhere in that Commonwealth, or elsewhere beyond the Commonwealth. Crazy. You know, people flying around the world to get here to pick fruit and not allowing people just down the road, so to speak, in the European Union to come. Madness. And then we move on to a more general exchange that happened several years ago. It made a big impact on me at the time, which is why I remember it. Tony Blair was Prime Minister, and he was doing one of those Prime Ministerial meetings with the liaison committee, you know, those chairs of committees of MPs. And Tony Wright, the then Labour MP and chair of one of those committees, asked Blair a question. It was sort of from nowhere, really. And it was this. He said, "Prime Minister, do you have a population policy?" And Blair looked taken aback and said, "What do you mean, Tony? A population? You know, you'll have to explain that one." And Tony Wright said, "Well, governments seek to control many things, from the currency, you know, the Britain kept the pound and joined the euro to keep control of the exchange rate and so on. Governments have an interest in unemployment levels and so on. Has the government got a policy on population?" And then he went on population levels. And then he went on to give a sort of example. He said, "Look, do we want the restaurants to have all the waiters they need, even if it means in the town where all the waiters are coming, there are fewer places to see a doctor because they are seeing the doctor along with the people who were here in the first place before the waiters arrived to fill the vacancies?" And Tony Blair was again bewildered. He said, "Oh, you know, they're filling jobs, right? You know, freedom of movement is a good thing. It drives economic activity." Which it does, but it's a reminder of the complexities of the immigration debate from the other perspective, if you like, that freedom of movement, though it did drive economic growth and would do again, comes with consequences. A government is not then in control and cannot have what Tony Wright called a population policy. It cannot judge what level of population combines the need for economic growth with a judgment on whether public services, which are always creaking at best in Britain and at the moment are dire, you know, you have to make, governments cannot make that judgment because if people want to come, say from the EU, they were free to do so and then use Britain's public services. Now, of course, they contributed to public services. One of the reasons why the NHS is in such a dire state is all those Eastern Europeans have gone on the whole, and we need them back. But you have to make, or should, in theory, be able to make a judgment as an elected government whether the UK's appalling house building program and lack of housing in key parts of the country, its creaking health service, is ready to respond to the increase in demand, even as the labour shortage issue is being met by people coming from the European Union. So these are complex matters that involve a grown-up debate to resolve. They are not simple. Freedom of movement in itself, you can be hailed, but then there needs to be a grown-up debate about consequences, especially the impact on public services. And then there is a debate on principle. You know, if a government believes, a democratic government, it has a responsibility in certain areas, why not in the end over population? You know, you could argue, for example, that take back control involves a judgment that a government has a right to make about the numbers involved. But then even if you do that, which is a sort of kind of grown-up debate to have, it doesn't become grown up in Britain because you will not hear Sunak or indeed Starmer say, "We have taken back control and have made a judgment. We need vast numbers coming over here more than ever on the basis of the figures being announced later this week to fill the vacancies. And it's our judgment and we welcome it because the vacancies have to be filled or else this economic crisis will deepen rather than resolve itself." But that won't happen. I say, "Oh, no, it's terrible. Got to get them down. Got to get them down." So on it goes in a way that is so pathetically childish. The populist card is about taking back control. There's a sort of hint about kick these bloody foreigners out, kick them out. There's a hint of that in the low-level debate. But as I say, those who argue as I do that the free movement has been one of the lack of it has been at a huge cost to Britain. Are we willing to elect governments that have no capacity or space to make judgments about population levels and what works and what is sustainable with Britain's rubbish public services, and whether they improve as a matter of course with the likes of free movement or increased immigration, even if that also leads to a demand? Those are the kind of debates we should be having, and it shouldn't be difficult. The newspapers here, with their hysteria on the front pages, makes it much more difficult. The debate in the Tory party, which is so feverish now that deep down they realise Brexit has been a catastrophe, or they kind of half realise it. That Farage thing, Brexit is a failure. He then added, because this government has not delivered it as it should have been delivered. Bad as the EU commissioners. It's a very interesting phase of the Brexit debate, this one, where the Brexiteers acknowledge it's been a failure, but then blame each other for the failure. They don't say they were wrong. They blame others who haven't delivered it properly. It's happening all over the place. It's a very interesting stage in a failed revolution, where the revolutionaries turn on themselves. It sort of began with David Davis, the Theresa May's first Brexit secretary, saying unbelievably that it was a Remainery Brexit. That was his excuse for it going badly wrong. A Remainery Brexit? The main architects, Johnson and Frost. Frost, the most revolutionary hard Brexiteer in his sort of deluded fantasy world. And now we have Farage saying it's a failure, but blaming this government for not implementing it properly. And so you have that kind of low-level, immature debate, which is partly about the borders and immigration. Again, a kind of fantasy world, utterly divorced from the needs of the economy. But you also lack a sensible debate about, well, you know, how do we make judgments about numbers and the labour force and public services and whether they will ever be equipped to both welcome people coming in to fill the endless vacancies and to deal with the needs of them and their families. I mean, they can't deal with anything at the moment. So these are kind of deep questions. They're also interesting ones. But instead, you listen to the shouting match this week over the numbers rising, they've got to come down. It will be one of my missions, you know, that Sunak's missions will be boat people, but also immigration. And I say Labour will be too scared to say anything grown up. And so it just remains silly, silly, silly. Anyway, there are some thoughts, because it's going to be a big, big story this week with many, many consequences. And now, if it's okay with all of you, we come over to questions where we're going to range widely and deeply. And for those of you who want to raise points or join in the debate, I get now hundreds and hundreds each week. The email is steverick14@icloud.com. The legendary academic and author Tim Bale has been in touch, wondering about Sunak's media strategy. It's always interesting how prime ministers try and project, or in this case, perhaps choose not to project. Tim was referring to a column by the Spectator correspondent Isabel Hardman, who says there are real doubts about Sunak's media strategy, which is basically quite often to keep ministers off the air, because they're only questioned about things that are going wrong. And the news story, therefore, becomes their response to things going wrong, and it all just fuels the negative narrative. But she was pointing out that in the vacuum, all you get are the troublemakers. And as we explored together in the podcast a week ago, when there is a vacuum, there are plenty of troublemakers in the Tory parliamentary party and beyond to fill it. And so she argued that this was kind of counterproductive. And Tim wondered about this. And To be honest, I think it doesn't matter that much. I'm going to be interviewing Tim soon, so maybe we can explore that. He delves deep when it comes to the Conservative Party. He's got a new book out about them, and we will be exploring and delving deep. I don't think it matters because Sunak and his media people are right that when a government is in trouble, appearing on the media often fuels the trouble. And so you might as well not go on and keep off. However, that doesn't cure it. The trouble continues. The only way to deal with the trouble is to address it at a fundamental level. And you can't do it at this stage of an electoral cycle. Long period in power, MPs working on the assumption they're going to lose, fractious. They wonder whether Sunak can guide them to anything like something approximating a victory at the next election, and therefore they stir. But where I think number 10 is right is very interesting. To go back to a past example, when ministers were supplying outlets as a matter of course, which was the build-up to the 97 election as the Tory parliamentary party fell apart. And I've got no doubt at all that appearing just fueled the story. So, for example, just to give one example, the Sunday Times famously put on its front page a photo of John Major at a Tory function, appearing to have his head in his hands in despair. Now, in reality, he was just getting a glass of water or something. Obviously, he wouldn't show such despair in a vivid manner in a public place. But they put that photo on and sort of built around it Major in crisis. And the BBC, who always follows up these stories, put in a bid for the Tory chairman at the time, Norman Fowler, to defend Major, which Fowler agreed to do, and he defended Major. But that just kind of fueled the story. A Tory party chairman defends the prime minister, blah, 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 taxes critics, and on it goes. So there is no solution, but I can understand why number 10 are reluctant to add fuel to the flames, which is what happens when a governing party or indeed an opposition party is in trouble. Thanks, Tim. Looking forward to our conversation together soon. Now, Dominic Jewell. Now, Dominic Jewell is normally our French correspondent. She still is, but she also worked for a time in Northern Ireland. And she's been in a never-ending dialogue with the Reverend Canon Paul Arbuthnot from Dublin. They're back in an exchange again after Paul's email from last week. So Dominique writes, "I can't agree with the Reverend Canon Paul Arbuthnot's assertion that Sinn Féin ought to serve their constituents by taking their seats at the Westminster Parliament. The position of Sinn Féin is very clear. They don't believe that the British government should have any say in the affairs of those living on the island of Ireland any more than Sinn Féin should have any influence on the affairs of Britain. Given that their historical policy of abstentionism provides Sinn Féin with a strong electoral mandate for their position, not taking their seats is exactly what their supporters and constituents have voted for." Yeah, well, I have to say, Dominica, I see absolutely no sign of that changing. Now, whether the DUP shifts its position on the Assembly, which Paul thinks they will do, let's wait and see. But there we are. It's a very interesting dialogue, the two of you. And thank you for giving your perspective this week. Harry Lewis writes, it's in the context of the conversation. Thank you very much, by the way, for all the kind emails about the conversation with a despairing Anthony Seldon reflecting on Boris Johnson. I could see him. You could only hear him. He did have his head in his hands on the desk where he was speaking from. John Major didn't in that Sunday Times photo, or not intentionally. Anyway, Harry Lewis writes, "What exactly does a modern cabinet member actually do? I was struck listening to Anthony Seldon and reading his book at how little mentions there are of the role of cabinet ministers in actually helping to formulate and shape policy. From watching and reading your presentations," very kindly talking about me, "of the prime ministers we never had and the prime ministers, I gather that big cabinet members of the past, Jenkins, Benn, Heseltine, Butler, were integral to the overall discussion and implementation of policy ideas. At what point did this change? Yeah, it's a very good question. The cabinet under Johnson was uniquely weak and chosen to be weak. Johnson, as I discussed with Anthony Seldon, couldn't cope with scrutiny in any form, from wives, former wives, cabinet, senior officials, parliament, Andrew Neil, wherever you look, he couldn't cope with scrutiny. So he chose a cabinet who wouldn't scrutinise. And in fairness to him, after winning big in December 2019, was in a strong enough position to do what he wanted anyway. Prime ministers with big majorities can ignore a cabinet, or more to the point, a cabinet doesn't challenge a prime minister who appears so mighty. And this cabinet, say, was uniquely subservient. They didn't scrutinise the Johnson-Frost Brexit deal or anything else, really. Until, of course, the end, when a cabinet can bring down a prime minister. It was the cabinet who brought down Johnson, in effect, by refusing to serve, except for a few sycophants or people who misread their ambition to a point where they actually continue to serve until they actually expose themselves to be so pathetic they are now nowhere. So cabinets can be powerful in that sense, but not in any other. When did it change? I think it began actually in the New Labour era. I think Blair, to some extent, in knowing that the perception of Thatcher as a strong prime minister, he read that partly as being utterly dominant over the cabinet. He wasn't wholly, of course. Gordon Brown was the counter. It wasn't a cabinet government, it was Blair Brown government. But Thatcher, in fact, did have a cabinet, many of the senior figures of which challenged her and actually disagreed with her. She had people like Ken Clark, Douglas Hurd. Nigel Lawson famously disagreed with her towards the end, though not when they were dancing together to form a settlement that's still in place. So I kind of think, but the Blair cabinets on the whole were fearful of Blair and or Brown and tended to dance to their tunes. But it was Johnson who took it about 50 miles further up that kind of dynamic of prime ministerial dominance and the rest of the subservient until they struck, and then he was gone. Thank you very much. Anthony Wilson in Blazing Exeter. Nick Radcliffe made the same point from Edinburgh. Now that Nigel Farage has done us all a favour and stated what we have known all along, namely that Brexit has been a shambles, can we expect Keir Starmer and his team to continue to soften their tone on making closer ties with Europe in terms of security, defence, science and even trade? Well, I'm pleased Exeter is blazing, Anthony. It remains overcast and cold in London. It's been like that for about 9 months. Yeah, I don't know what it's like in Edinburgh, Nick. I hope it's sunny in August for the festival. I'm getting diverted. Well, it's interesting. Keir Starmer spoke at a conference last week where he talked about the need for closer ties to remove some of these insane barriers to this bigger single market on our doorstep. And the Mail went bonkers. The Tories, that shows he wants to end Brexit. If only you Tory Brexiteers and the Daily Mail. He knows he can't do that and won't do that. And it is hard to frame, again, a grown-up debate about this in a media which is hysterical. There are echoes, and of course it's related to the immigration debate that we've been discussing in this podcast. So, yeah, I think they will, in government, if they get to government, move closer in quite a constructive way, but limited, because they won't go back into the single market in the first term. But they will have to move closer if Keir Starmer is to achieve this mission of higher growth than anyone else in the G7. Now, how they do that and how the EU responds are questions I think they are privately exploring, but it will not be loudly so before the election. And you can see why when you get that hysterical response, as if Brexit is such a triumph. Any attempt to revise, and by the way, all elements of it will have to be revisited. There are time-limited reviews coming up, whoever is in power. Oh, but it's so difficult with these newspapers screaming madly about the joys of Brexit and that can never be undermined under any circumstance. Talking of which, Charlotte Aldrich writes, One question following your episode on the stirring of the Tory right is the degree to which the public is conscious of that ideological party within the the ideological battle within the party and the impact that might have on the voting intentions. For example, the BBC reported that Danny Kruger made a speech about the need to reaffirm the nuclear family and the sanctity of marriage between one man and one woman. There will be many prospective Conservative voters for whom this is music to their ears, and perhaps that any party who is home to these views shares their values. Rather than seeing a divided party, light touch voters might see the party returning to its roots, so strengthening its position. I'll answer that in a second. To sort of reinforce that view, we've had another very useful email from our white van driver, Andy, who says, once again, keeping a beady eye on our far-right fringe, and he calls him Lee Neanderthal. You know, the vice chairman of the Conservative Party has at least been explicit in his strategy. Now they don't have Brexit, Boris and Corbyn. And he sends me the headline, Lee Anderson says Tories should fight the election on culture wars and trans debate. Oh, can you imagine this election campaign? It's going to be nasty, vile at times. Now, Andy then returns to say, I believe the collective would be unwise. This is kind of the point being made by Charlotte in the previous email. I believe the collective would be unwise to dismiss the speakers as fruitcakes and scoff too loudly at the live audience figures for stuff like the he sent me a YouTube clip from the conference, smartly clipped and posted on the socials. This highly organized and US-funded hate farming gets real traction in my world of work, at my Redwall Town pub, and amongst some friends only too keen to go there as they get older. Lofty condescension from us progressives helped us lose the Brexit referendum, and I see a lot of same sneering attitudes again in the long lead up to the election in 2024. So yeah, both very important counterpoints that some of these messages have great potency. Social conservatism has always had that potency with certain sections of the electorate, but without being complacent at all, because, you know, I kind of work on the assumption the Conservatives win general elections with the kind of record since I've been able to vote, done with great authority and experience. But I actually do think, to go to the first point, divided parties and parties seen as being disturbed do struggle to win, actually. So I think that kind of trumps it. And the other thing is this, that it is interesting. Although social conservatism and, you know, husband and wife families with the implication that the rest are all wrong, you know, lock a lot of them up, trans, all this kind of thing. What is so interesting, I've got this book out, which I'll be talking more about in September, called Turning Points in Modern Britain. And one of the turning points that have endured are the kind of social liberal reforms that Roy Jenkins and others introduced in the mid to late 60s. Not only have they endured, they've been developed since gay marriage, which this lot introduced. I think, you know, partly because some of them believed it, partly as a protective shield to claim they were centrist modernizers when in economic policy they were on the right and so on. But they do endure. And so I think in the end, this sort of playing to a kind of 1950s social conservatism, yes, it resonates to some extent, but I don't think to a wide enough electorate, and it divides the Tory party, because there are a load of Tory liberals, including, by the way, Johnson, in the party as well. So that's my thoughts, but thanks for offering the counter thing, that it could, you know, this whole culture wars thing could be one of their ace cards in an election where they will have very few. Not the economy, not the state of public services. So where do they turn? Jonathan Roberts wants to put himself forward as a provider of rock and roll in the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative, as a lifelong amateur musician. And Jonathan reminds me that in King's Place, he kindly gave me a copy of his concept album, which was charting the political changes from the 50s to the coalition. I remember it well, Jonathan. I remember you offering a theme tune for the live show and the podcast. But I tell you, Jonathan, people really, on the whole, love the theme tune and ask where it came from, the existing one. But your album is fantastic. Anyway, he wants to challenge me about my comment on the Lib Dems in the 2010 coalition. He said that he says we, the Lib Dems, didn't enthusiastically aid and abet the Tory government. The country was in a shaky state after the crash. Gordon Brown had clearly lost, and Nick Clegg felt some compromise was required to bring about stability. Regardless of the many things which can be criticised about the coalition, it was stable and a rare example of grown-up politics. Well, that's, I think, a slight kind of rewriting, if I might say so, in the sense that Nick Clegg was really enthusiastic in the early years. Now, it might have been an affectation to convey stability that two parties were ruling, but I don't think it was that. For example, I met Nick Clegg in his office on the day that Andrew Lansley produced his reforms for the NHS, which had to be revised and was still implemented chaotically. And Nick was really enthusiastic about them, saying this was a great conflation between Lib Dem ideas of localism and the Tory support for the market and so on. And so, yeah, I think that, you see, the Orange Book liberal wing prevailed during that period on the whole. Ed Davey is now passionately anti-Tory. There was a very moving interview he gave to The Guardian last week that many of you will have read, where he conveyed it with great passion. And of course, he did, when he was in the cabinet, try and get the Cameron apparent enthusiasm for green issues back on board. You know, Cameron pretended with his early slogan, "Go vote blue, go green," and then in government said, "What's all this green crap?" A revealing political journey. And Ed Davey pushed it very hard, but I think they did enthuse too much and haven't fully explored why. You know, are they economic liberals close to that kind of Thatcherite approach to the economy? Or are they kind of David Steele, Charles Kennedy, Social Democrats going back to the tradition of Lloyd George? Can they combine the two and so on? Now, I admit where they are now is very different, but I think there was some enthusiasm. But I take your point and keep rocking for the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative. Well, we've been going for some time now. Oh, yeah, and thank you again for the CD. It's great, and I really appreciate it. I won't use new music for the podcast and the live shows for now, if that's okay. Anyway, look, thank you very much for listening. We've got another interview coming up, and thanks all of you for the kind comments about Anthony Seldon on Boris Johnson. I had to go and lie down in a darkened room afterwards. His despair kind of fed my despair, even though I don't show it in these podcasts. Oh, yeah. Before we go, could I thank those of you who subscribe to Patreon and urge more of you to do so? We're now doing live streams. There are podcasts on all kinds of themes and series from what was the most recent? Troublemakers. There's one more troublemaker to come. Da-da-da-da, next month. Political troublemakers, dramatic, cinematic, general elections, all kinds of things. Anyway, I hope you can subscribe. Those who do, thank you so much. Oh, yeah. You get bonus mugs. You get the podcast early, ad-free. And in certain cases, you can get tickets for the shows and things. Anyway, what I sometimes forget to do is thank those of you who do subscribe. So I'm going to thank a few of you today. Susan Lintott, who's written to me about other matters, including praising the BBC this very week. Penny Smith, Madeline French, Mark Wardrop, Stephen J. is it Dimelo, Stephen? Dimelo? Mike McTominay, Delith Gregory. Thank you very much indeed to subscribe. More names to be read out in the weeks to come. Yeah, and if you could leave a review, only if you like it. That gets us up the charts, and there's a real competitive battle in those charts. It's like Blur versus Oasis versus Pulp, or T-Rex versus Slade from distant decades. Anyway, look, thanks so much. Enjoy the cooking, running, drinking, and making sense of it all. There's going to be a lot going on, so let's gather again very soon, and some great interviews coming up too. Thank you. Bye.